Taxanes are integral to the systemic management of non-small cell lung cancer, and a number of new clinical trials are evaluating nanoparticle paclitaxel. I met with Dr. Tom Stinchcomb, who was among a number of presenters of study data on this agent at the 2006 ASCO meeting. Dr. Stinchcomb began our conversation by providing a background to this work.
Abraxane is an albumin-bound paclitaxel. We know a standard formulation paclitaxel incorporated with a cremophore base in order to make it a solution that can be infused. The cremophore base is responsible for a lot of the hypersensitivity reactions that we see, and it may contribute to the neuropathy that is a toxicity of Taxol. What Abraxane is an albumin-bound paclitaxel, and the hypothesis is that you've eliminated the cremophore base, which may be contributing somewhat to the toxicity. Also, I think that there's a potential for increased efficacy in that we know that tumor cancer cells have a way of transporting albumin particles into their tumor cells, and also that there's some cancer cells or tumor cells have an increased in spark, that is a protein that binds albumin, and therefore the Abraxane may have a higher intertuminal level of paclitaxel than standard formulation of paclitaxel.
Can you talk a little bit more about spark?
It's a secreted protein, acidic and rich in cysteine. It's sometimes excreted from tumor cells and also found in the tumor cells, and it binds albumin at a high rate. And if we think intellectually, it's natural that a tumor cell will develop a way of collecting albumin as an energy source, as also a way of collecting amino acids so it can support its growth. And with the albumin-bound paclitaxel, it's thought that the spark may act as like an albumin sink of the albumin-bound paclitaxel. Thus, this may contribute to some of the increased intertumoral levels seen with Abraxane.
Can you review the available clinical research information on nab-paclitaxel and lung cancer?
I think there's some significant phase 2 trials. There was one trial that was presented as an abstract by Mike Hawkins. It was with carboplatin in combination with Abraxane. It was a cohort design where 25 patients were enrolled sequentially at each cohort with a dose of Abraxane escalating from 225 up to 340 milligrams per meter squared every 3 weeks. These cohorts showed a response rate of approximately 25% in all the cohorts. Additional 15% of patients had stable disease. The combination of carboplatin and Abraxane appeared to be relatively well tolerated, and particularly there was a low rate of myelosuppression. And I think this was quite impressive. In addition to that trial, there's a single agent Abraxane trial in patients with ECOG 0 to 1 that was written by Dr. Mark Green, who's published in Annals of Oncology. And this showed a progression-free survival rate around 6 months and an overall survival of approximately 11 months. And I think that's quite significant because that's generally the progression-free survival and overall survival we generally see with double-agent chemotherapies. And so this is promising data.
What about the data you presented at ASCO?
I presented a phase 1 trial. It was looking at carboplatin in combination with Abraxane on 3 different schedules. It was in patients with all tumor types. It was a very heavily pretreated patient population with a median number of prior therapies of 3. One schedule was Abraxane every 3 weeks, and our maximum tolerated dose was 300 milligrams per meter squared in combination with carboplatin AC of 6 every 3 weeks. And the second schedule was Abraxane on days 1, 8, 15, carboplatin day 1, a 28-day cycle. And at that, the maximum tolerated dose was 100 milligrams per meter squared. The third arm was a carboplatin day 1 with Abraxane days 1, 8 every 21 days. And the maximum tolerated dose there was 125 milligrams per meter squared. We were able to treat with significant doses of Abraxane, even in a heavily pretreated patient population. The main dose-limiting toxicities were myelosuppression, particularly thrombocytopenia, and that may have been related to the patient population and the carboplatin.
Can you talk a little bit about the potential clinical advantages of Abraxane and how specifically they might be useful in lung cancer patients?
I think the particular uses are that in the phase 3 trial that was done in breast cancer, there was a lower rate of grade 4 neutropenia, which was statistically significant. I think also in that trial that there's a higher response rate and time to tumor progression, showing increased efficacy over standard formulation paclitaxel in breast cancer. I think that the efficacy data in breast cancer is very intriguing to us. I think there could be a potential toxicity benefit. Obviously, patients with lung cancer many times have cardiopulmonary disease, incidents of febrile neutropenia could be potentially life-threatening or infection. And so a lower rate of myelosuppression would be a significant advantage. I think we're also intrigued that there was increased efficacy in the breast cancer literature and seeing if that potentially may exist in non-small cell lung cancer. I think the other avenue that we're interested in exploring is small cell lung cancer. In our phase 1 trial, we saw some very nice responses in patients who had been previously treated for small cell lung cancer. One patient even in the third line setting after they'd received a platinum in the first line setting and a taxane in the second line setting. The advantage of a carboplatin Abraxane combination in small cell would be, of course, a reduction in the febrile neutropenia, because our current treatments of cisplatin and irinotecan have a significant incidence of febrile neutropenia of approximately 5%. Also, I think if we can give carboplatin Abraxane every 3 weeks, it would be a significant improvement over the current cisplatinum and etoposide days 1 through 3 or carboplatin and etoposide days 1 through 3 as far as patient convenience.
How much of an advantage do you think it is to be able to avoid pre-medication and allergic reactions?
I think that's a significant advantage. We know that the hypersensitivity reactions occur in standard formulation paclitaxel around 3%, and these can be a significant event to the patient and also can be sometimes life-threatening. The pre-medication also makes it somewhat cumbersome, and that some patients do have diabetes and get hyperglycemia related to the dexamethasone. Also, the standard formulation paclitaxel requires a 3-hour infusion, and Abraxane only requires a 30-minute infusion, so it could make the visit more efficient for the patient as well. I think the infusion-related reactions, we've all grown very accustomed to managing. I don't think that most of us could, if we could avoid them, would, because, I mean, they are a significant event to the patient and potentially life-threatening.
What do we know about neuropathy in terms of the trials in lung cancer? It's been stated in some of the breast cancer trials, they raised the question of whether the neuropathy resolves faster. Have we seen that with lung cancer?
In the breast cancer trial, there's a higher incidence of neuropathy compared to standard formulation paclitaxel. However, it resolved in a median of, I think, 21 days versus 42 days, I think, for the standard formulation paclitaxel. So even though there's an increased incidence, they tended to resolve faster. We know from the Hawkins trial of carboplatin and Abraxane that there was a higher rate of grade 3 neuropathy at higher 340 milligrams per meter squared, but I believe they saw a quicker resolution as well to the neuropathy. So I think that the neuropathy, while present, may be more manageable or may resolve quicker. There was one other trial with a carboplatin and Abraxane. It was a carboplatin on day 1 and Abraxane days 1, 8, 15. It was done through the Sarah Cannon group presented by Allerton. This also had a very impressive response rate, around 25%, and an impressive median survival. They started off with Abraxane at 100 milligrams per meter squared in the first cohort, and they subsequently have dose escalated up to 125 milligrams per meter squared on days 1, 8, and 15, and that trial is ongoing. I think that will provide additional efficacy data about the weekly schedule of carboplatin and Abraxane, and it looks very promising.
Any gut feeling in terms of how it's going to play out over the next couple of years in terms of weekly versus Q3 weeks?
I personally like the every 3-week treatment schedule just out of patient convenience. I think the weekly schedule, you'll most likely have a slightly decreased incidence of myelosuppression, largely because you can modify the day 15 dose if necessary or hold of a day 15 dose. I'm a little bit concerned in the trial of carboplatin Taxol on the every 3 weeks versus the weekly that there's increased incidence of anemia with the weekly treatment. We know that most lung cancer patients become pretty symptomatic from even a mild anemia, largely due to their other cardiopulmonary disease. So in my opinion, unless there's a significant increase in efficacy of the weekly over the every 3 weeks, my bias would go with the every 3-week treatment.
Where do you see things heading with Abraxane, and at what point do you think it might become incorporated into sort of non-protocol management in lung cancer?
Abraxane has several potential developmental areas within non-small cell lung cancer and small cell lung cancer. I think that there's interest in performing a phase 3 trial against standard formulation paclitaxel to see if it may be superior. That would probably be done in combination with carboplatin. I think that that would be one advantage. It may be superior on efficacy or toxicity, which I think would be a valuable step forward. There's a phase 2 trial currently ongoing with carboplatin, Abraxane, and Avastin. Craig Reynolds is heading that. And I think that that's another potential area of development. I think on the ECOG 4599 trial, there was a statistically significant increase in the rate of neutropenia with a combination of carboplatin, paclitaxel, and Avastin. I personally don't think that was a clinically significant difference, but I think that if we can reduce that with a potentially carboplatin, Abraxane, Avastin combination, that would maybe reduce the risk. I think those are some areas of development. I think there's also some interest if we're going to develop a platinum-based combination with a second agent with Avastin and potentially a multi-targeted tyrosine kinase inhibitor or potentially a fourth agent. We're going to have to minimize the toxicity that we see with our platinum platform so that we don't have an increased rate of neutropenia or other complications. So therefore, if we're to potentially develop a 4-drug therapy for non-small cell lung cancer, it might benefit us to have a taxane that is better tolerated with less myelosuppression at that point.
What do you think the mechanism is whereby it causes less myelosuppression?
I think that that's an area of increasing interest, I think. I'm not exactly sure. I think that it might be less bone marrow circulation due to the fact that it's albumin-bound, because I think that there's some leaching. But I have to be honest, I'm not exactly certain of why the exact pathophysiology, whether it appears to be lower neutropenia.
What about in the adjuvant setting? Do you think we're going to need phase 3 randomized trials before, you know, we substitute Abraxane for paclitaxel?
I think that in the adjuvant setting is a sort of an evolving field now with the CLGB and the carboplatin taxol being negative. I think that in the adjuvant setting, since you're treating with a curative setting, I think that most people would want a phase 3 trial at that point, proving that it is equivalent or, you know, potentially better than the standard, particularly when treating with a curative setting. I think in other settings, such as the metastatic setting, where I think the standard formulations or standard platinum doublets, the efficacy is fairly well known, I think most people would be happy with a strong phase 2 trial before implementing that in a non-curative setting.
You mentioned the CALGB trial that was just reported at the ASCO meeting. Can you talk a little bit about the design of that study and what this most recent report showed?
The trial was initially intended to be a 500-patient trial. Due to slow recruit, they reduced the size to 384 patients with expected 155 deaths, and then that reduced the statistical power. The trial was initially presented at ASCO 2004, at which point it was a positive trial. Many of us were very encouraged at this point and enthusiastic. On further follow-up, it did not provide an overall survival benefit. It did provide a disease-free survival benefit overall. If you did a subset analysis of the patients with the tumors under 4 centimeters, they did not appear to derive benefit from adjuvant chemotherapy, while those with a tumor equal to or greater than 4 centimeters did appear to derive some benefit. I think whenever doing a subset analysis, you have to be a little bit cautious, but I think that's somewhat encouraging that there is a group of patients with a larger tumor who presumably have a higher rate of relapse may derive benefit from the treatment with a carboplatin paclitaxel in the adjuvant setting.
What's your take in terms of what's going on here?
I think there's probably a combination of factors. I think one that is probably statistically play, where it's maybe not enough events. I think also if you take a step back and look at other tumor types, such as colorectal cancer, there's been a big debate about the adjuvant therapy for B2 colon cancers, and they've had 10 or 20 years of adjuvant chemotherapy data. I think the same debate existed in lymph node negative breast cancer about 20 years ago. And I think that as you go into the earlier stages, it sometimes can be more difficult to prove the benefit of adjuvant chemotherapy. And I think that's critical. I think that also the CLGB trial, when it stopped, was one of the smaller of the adjuvant trials. Thus, you had a patient population that was at lower risk of relapse and a smaller trial, which was probably not ideal for evaluating the issue.
What's been the regimen that you've been utilizing in the adjuvant setting?
We've had a trial with carboplatin and docetaxel at UNC, which has sort of allowed us to sidestep some of these issues. Obviously, patients come in off trial. I think if you were to practice right now evidence-based medicine, you'd have to say the trials have been positive have been cisplatin-based. And of the trials, the second agent most frequently used was navalbine, which was used in the BR10 trial as well as the ANITA trial. About 50% of patients on the IL trial got etoposide. So I think that the second agents that are most proven are navalbine and etoposide. I don't have any evidence for this, to be honest with you, but my personal opinion is that the second agents right now is there's still going to be some dealer's choice at this point based on tolerability. I think it's the cisplatin backbone that has largely been proven at this point, and I think for the current situation, we're going to obligate it to the cisplatin, especially because we're treating in the curative setting.
Can you talk a little bit more about the study you're doing of carbo and docetaxel?
That was designed several years ago before the CLGB data became available, and the hope was that we could demonstrate feasibility with the carboplatin docetaxel as far as delivering the prescribed number of therapies and then scheduling the chemotherapy on time. So far, it's gone relatively well. We've had to incorporate growth factors because we had a significant rate of febrile neutropenia, and also the NCCN guidelines recommended growth factor support with a combination of carboplatin docetaxel, so we wanted to be compliant with NCCN guidelines at this point. So far, patients have tolerated it very well. It's a feasibility trial, so we're not going to be able to make any efficacy comments about it, and we're still accruing patients. But I can tell you on a preliminary, it looks like it's well tolerated, and maybe if selection, if it's proven to be equivalent.
Where are things right now in terms of the next sort of generation of adjuvant trials?
I think that the cooperative groups are in the process of developing a trial that would incorporate bevacizumab or Avastin into the adjuvant setting, which, based on the promising result of the positive trial that we've seen in ECOG, see if we can perhaps improve the cure rate with the addition of bevacizumab in the adjuvant setting. I think that trial is under development and is waiting final approval. And we will probably open that at UNC as well once it becomes approved.
What are your thoughts about looking at bevacizumab in the adjuvant setting, and particularly in terms of potential toxicities? How do you think it's going to play out?
I think that there's going to be obviously some concern whenever incorporating a new agent. I think some of the concerns are obviously there's issues of wound healing. That's why we'll probably wait like 4 or 8 weeks, much the way I think the colorectal treatments have. I think that in the metastatic setting, there was the episodes of hemoptysis, which were concerning. Presumably in the adjuvant setting, the tumor has been removed, so that's going to be less of a problem. I think whenever taking a therapy to an adjuvant setting, there's always more concern about treatment-related deaths. We're always concerned about them, but particularly if someone's potentially cured with surgery alone, we don't want to cause any additional toxicity or life-threatening toxicity. I think it'll be interesting to see that trial go forward, and I think it has a great promise.
Have you been using bevacizumab in your practice over the last year?
We've been using it as well. In particular, we have a stage 3 trial that we are using it on, which incorporates carboplatinum, paclitaxel, and bevacizumab for 2 cycles of induction chemotherapy, followed by carboplatinum, paclitaxel weekly with bevacizumab and thoracic radiation to 74, followed by consolidation with bevacizumab and Tarceva or erlotinib. At that point, it's a phase 1, phase 2 trial. We will incorporate the erlotinib into the thoracic radiation portion. We'll have some intermittent dosing of the erlotinib, trying to think in that sequential incorporation of erlotinib into chemotherapy may have more effect. We're also very interested in seeing the interaction with thoracic radiation therapy as well.
I'm curious what you've observed in terms of treatment of patients with metastatic disease with bevacizumab, and particularly the responses and response duration. I don't know if you've seen enough patients to sort of comment on that.
We've seen some impressive responses in metastatic settings. We're still just incorporating it, to be honest. They seem durable in the handful of patients that we've done and on.
You mentioned the stage 3 study that you're doing. Can you sort of talk a little bit about where we are overall with stage 3 disease, and what are some of the clinical research questions that need to be answered in the next few years?
I think stage 3 is probably the most controversial stage of the therapy of lung cancer at this point. I think one of the bigger questions is, where does the role of surgery incorporate? You're well aware of the intergroup trial 139, where the overall trial showed no benefit in overall survival. However, on subgroup analysis, it appeared that the patients with lobectomy derived some benefit. That was a retrospective subset analysis, so I think it's very intriguing and that data looks promising, but I'd like to think we have to view it with a little bit of caution. I think the vast majority of patients will be the unresectable stage 3 disease patients who will get primary chemotherapy and radiation therapy. At this point, there are several trials ongoing, I think, that are very important. One is the Hoosier Oncology Group trial that is treating with cisplatin etoposide thoracic radiation therapy and randomization to docetaxel or placebo, looking at the efficacy and the toxicity of consolidation docetaxel in a phase 3 setting. I'm hopeful that those results will be available soon. I think that's a promising approach, and it'll be interesting to see if additional chemotherapy is of benefit.
Can you talk a little bit about multi-targeted TKIs in lung cancer, including some of the data your group presented at ASCO?
I think there's an increasing interest in some of the multi-targeted tyrosine kinase and new agents in lung cancer. Mark Szczynski, my boss, presented the second-line sunitinib data, which showed a promising response rate of around 9.5% in the second-line setting. I think that's very promising. The sorafenib in the second-line setting data was also very promising, and the ZD6474. I think the next step, of course, while these agents have shown individual activity, would be potentially incorporating them into the standard platinum-based platform that we commonly use in lung cancer so that we can have a platinum, and a second agent, and potentially a multi-targeted tyrosine kinase to see if that could improve our first-line therapies. And then we have several trials in development exploring the generally phase 1 or phase 2 trials that exploring these combinations at this point.
You mentioned ZD6474, which I think it goes under the name or will go under the name of Zactima. Can you talk a little bit about what that is and where it is right now in clinical development?
That is a drug that has anti-VEGF properties and anti-EGFR properties. And so it's a nation of anti-angiogenesis and EGFR inhibitor. And it's shown a significant amount of promise. At this year's ASCO, there was a phase 2 trial comparing ZD6474 to gefitinib that showed a significant improvement in progression-free survival on the ZD6474. Patients were allowed to cross over to the other treatment arm, so there was no improvement in overall survival, but that may be due to the patient population and the crossover. There's also a trial comparing ZD6474 to, it was a 3-arm phase 2 of docetaxel versus ZD6474 at 100 milligrams. And docetaxel, and then there was ZD6474 at 300 milligrams and docetaxel, and that showed that the ZD6474, 100 milligrams and docetaxel, had an impressive progression-free survival that was quite promising. I think in general, when we look at these phase 2 trials, I think looking at overall survival has become more complicated because many patients go on to subsequent therapies, and so that's become a difficult endpoint to really ascertain. But I think when you look at the progression-free survival, that looks promising on those 2 trials.
Did you have any patients on that trial, sunitinib?
Yeah, I had about 10 or 12 patients on the sunitinib trial. Our sunitinib trial had one cohort, which is 4 weeks on, 2 weeks off. And generally, I thought it was very well tolerated. There was some fatigue and some mild myelosuppression with it. There's also some changes in the pigmentation that some people reported. I had one patient who did have an episode of fatal hemoptysis on this. She was a squamous cell patient who got treated, came into the hospital related to some fatigue, and a chest x-ray looked like there was increased aeration of upper lobe lung, suggestive of a response at this point. And then she went home and subsequently had an episode of hemoptysis, which turned out to be fatal at home. She had a somewhat central lesion as well. So I think that this somewhat makes us aware that these agents that do have anti-angiogenesis properties, we might have to address the hemoptysis issue with them as well and be very selective in the patients that we use these agents in. We have a second cohort that's ongoing that has a dose of 37.5 milligrams continuously. In my personal experience, which is you have to take with a grain of salt, there appears to be less fatigue and appears to be better tolerated than the 4 weeks on, 2 weeks off. Other issues, I think, if you think intellectually, we know that if you stop an anti-VEGF inhibitor, oftentimes that can result in a rebound activity. So the continuous dosing is a little bit more intellectually appealing to me.
Do you find that when you have the 2 weeks off, at the end of the 2 weeks, they're kind of back to normal with the fatigue, or are they still tired?
I think they're generally bounced back to normal. I think sometimes it can be hard to grade fatigue in this population because sometimes there's disease progression, or sometimes they're going to be chronically fatigued, related somewhat to their cancer and their other cardiopulmonary morbidities. But my sort of foot of the bed test would be that most patients do improve on that 2 weeks off and get a little bit increased energy.
You know, that patient you described sounds a lot like some of the cases with bevacizumab where the patients seem to be responding, maybe cavitation. Any thoughts about it? What's going on? Do you think it's just tumor response or in some way related to the anti-angiogenic effects?
I think these could be the patients who have a very rapid response and the tumor cavitation, and that's what could be really causing a significant number of these hemoptysis. And I think it's not only the degree of response, but maybe the rapidity of the response is what may be a contributing factor as well. Now, having said that, they did see the episodes of hemoptysis early as well as late on the ECOG trials, but I think it's very interesting, and I think it's one of the complications that we'll just have to work through like we did many of the other complications with other drugs.
Now, with your patient, how many courses had the patient received?
They had just received the four-week course and actually had stopped the sunitinib several days, I think 5 days beforehand when that event occurred.
So it was in the first cycle, basically.
Yeah. That's why we normally would repeat the CT scan after 6 weeks on that trial, and we didn't have a repeat CT scan to really more definitively determine what her response was, because I think that would have, ideally, the event would have happened, but if it did happen, we had some radiographic evidence, we might be able to give you more correlation with what was going on with her anatomy and her response.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to our speakers, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Lung Cancer Update.